Well, it's one thing to talk about God creating the universe by faith, but intelligent design, is that really science?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I've had this article on my desk for a week now. Just getting to it today. Most Americans believe in heaven and hell, according to the Pew Research Center. Isn't that interesting? 866-34-TRUTH. No, I'm not focusing on that today. I'm going to be joined by a guest shortly who is going to discuss intelligent design with us and the biological and scientific arguments for God creating, or an intelligent designer creating the universe and creating human life. We'll be talking about that. And if you have a question, any question relating to intelligent design, ID, any question relating to God as creator, or apparent conflicts between science and the Bible, or issues of evolution and the Bible and science, we'll be taking your questions today, 866-34-TRUTH. But what I want to say first is that Scripture reminds us that it is God who is invisible who created everything that is visible. And even though we are a thoroughly materialistic society, we are addicted to things, we live for things, our focus is on this world in America as a result of the abundance and prosperity and carnality of our generation. The fact is that people still realize there must be more. People still realize that after this world, there's got to be more. Oh, not all, but many. People still realize that there's a final judgment or a final reward. Now, it's funny, not surprising that more Americans believe in heaven than in hell. So out of those who were surveyed by this Pew Research poll, 72% of Americans believe in heaven, says of 2014. 58% believe in hell. And as these numbers break down, those who identify as Christian, 85% believe in heaven, 70% believe in hell. Among those who identify as Jewish, 40% believe in heaven, 22% believe in hell. That would be because most Jews nationally are not religious. And that religious. Muslims, 89% believe in heaven, 76% in hell. Buddhists, 47% in heaven, 32% in hell. And Hindus, a similar 48 and 28%. That would be largely because of religious beliefs that are different in terms of heaven and hell. But, here's the key thing. Here's the key thing we've got to take hold of and recognize. There is a knowledge, there is an understanding that there is something more. There is a knowledge, there is an understanding, something that God's put within human beings, and some just the result of our religious traditions, recognition that there must be something beyond this world, that there is a spiritual realm along with a natural realm, and the spiritual realm is real. Now, of course, the irony is always that if you ask people, do they believe they're going to heaven or do they believe they're going to hell? Then overwhelmingly, you're going to have people say they believe they're going to heaven. Even those who believe there is a hell, hell's maybe for like Adolf Hitler kind of people. Hell's for an ISIS executioner. But for good people like you and me, no, we all go to heaven. And that would be a very common belief as well. But I just thought it was interesting, wanted to mention it. And it ties in directly with the subject of intelligent design because the reality is that there is a reality beyond what we can see and feel and touch. And what we can see and feel and touch points to that reality.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. We should be connecting shortly with Jonathan McClatchy in England, and we'll be discussing intelligent design. Yeah, Betsy, I believe it's just a straight international call, so we'll connect. All right, 866-34-TRUTH, if you have any questions for me. The refugee problem, we discussed this yesterday. We discussed the issue of what is a Christian response to the Syrian refugee problem. In point of fact, over 20 governors now across America have said, we're not taking in any Syrian refugees right now until we can work out background check issues and things like that, because we cannot risk letting terrorists into our borders. Now, on the one hand, this creates all kinds of challenges with the idea of, do you let 10 legitimate refugees in with the possibility of one terrorist among them, 100 with the possibility of one terrorist, or zero with the possibility of one terrorist? A colleague posted yesterday on Twitter some stats where Americans were up to 30 governors now. Thanks. It was 20-something as of last night, 30 now. Stats during right before World War II, late 1930s, about Americans taking in Jewish refugee children from Germany, and there was resistance to doing that. Most Americans didn't want to do that. We don't want to repeat something like that and close our doors, close our borders to those in legitimate need that we have the potential to help. However, we must do it intelligently. We must do it with wisdom. We must do it in such a way that ensures our safety while we're helping those in genuine need. And our president has said, well, we're very rigorous in our background checks and things like that. However, others have said, actually, we really can't tell. There's no way to do rigorous background checks. There's really no way to guarantee that we are not letting terrorists in. And then once they're here, we're not doing a good job of tracking. So this is a thorny issue. I do not have a simple answer or solution, other than to whatever extent Christians can get involved, working with Christian relief agencies to sponsor families. And then when they sponsor those families, they get directly involved in their lives with the gospel. Aside from that, this is a very thorny and difficult situation. And I, for one, don't know that we have a simple solution to it. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, tell you what. I'm just going to open up the phone lines as we are having a little bit of a problem connecting with our guest in England right now. I'm going to open up the phone lines for some random questions that have come in. So we'll do this a little bit. You've got questions, we've got answers. I didn't solicit those, but they're coming in anyway. And we'll either improvise in terms of which way we go in these next minutes, because we're always looking for more opportunities to take your questions, or we will successfully connect with our guest in England. Let's go to Lewis in Boston. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Hi,
you're on
Dr.
the air.
Brown. Thank you for Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the Trinity. How do I explain to my 13 years old the Trinity?
Sure. Well, everyone on a certain level needs to have divine insight, divine revelation that gives further understanding. But you could first explain that there's only one God, but just like human beings are complex, we have a body, we have a spirit, there's life inside of us, and yet we're physical, that God is complex also. And I would use the simple analogy of the physical sun, S-U-N, that when we look at the sun, that we actually don't see the sun itself. The core of it is invisible. It's too bright, too intense to be seen by human eyes. Then we see the shining out of the sun, the manifestation. When we look at it, we see what shines out from the sun. And then what is touching us and nourishing the earth is invisible, the rays of the sun that are feeding our plants and things like that and providing heat and light. But that's invisible to the naked eye. That's the same way with God. The Father, who is the source of all things, is completely invisible. The Father, who's the source of all things, completely invisible. The Son is how God is known. We see that. We see the Son, meaning Jesus. And then the Spirit works among us in an unseen way. So just as the Son has these three different aspects and yet it's one, so also God has three different aspects, in this case, three different persons, all in one. The key thing is to understand, one, is that God exists as the eternal only one, and two, that he is Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, if you've shared any of this with your 13-year-old, have they had any questions in response?
No, yeah, he says, well, so there is three gods? There are three gods? I said, no, there's only one. So I just wanted to get a
that the most simple way to explain it is, as I said, explain how a human being is complex, that when we die physically, there's still our soul that goes, and yet we work as perfect unity. Our brain, our mouths, our spirit, they're all working in perfect unity, and yet there is distinction there, the same way there's distinction within God. And, you know, after that, let the Lord give him insight. But the key thing is to understand there's only one God, and that give him an emphasis on the functions of each person. The Father is the source of all things. The Son is the one who makes him known. The Spirit is the one who works among us. But then say, hey, look, in the book of Revelation, it says when we see him, we're only going to see one God. So perhaps you could leave it there. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing. You know, it's always a challenge with children, isn't it? 866-34-TRUTH. All right. Let's go to Christian in Maine. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Dr. Brown, thanks so much, and appreciate all the work you do for the Lord. Dr. Brown, I was conversing with a client, and we were speaking about political things and social issues, and we talked about, that came up that when is a baby a human being? And she said, Christian, in my religion, we don't believe a baby is a human being until it takes its first breath. And I'm like, breath. And I said, really? What religion are you? She said, we're Christian, we're Jewish. And I said, I had no idea. I go, you know, and then I related that I was a Christian. And then we started to talk about Christ a little bit. And, but is that true?
Okay. There are different teachings within Judaism. There's the joke that Jews believe that life begins when the child leaves home. So that's another. In traditional Judaism, in Jewish law, all right, and I'm just looking, Dr. Fred Rosner was a well-known Orthodox Jewish doctor who wrote a lot about biomedical ethics and things like that. So here's what he says, and this would be authoritative Jewish tradition. An unborn fetus in Jewish law is not considered a person until it has been born. So that's the personhood. The fetus is regarded as a part of the mother's body and not a separate being until it begins to egress from the womb during childbirth. In fact, until 40 days after conception, the fertilized egg is considered as mere fluid. These facts form the basis of the Jewish law for abortion. So they would claim to find biblical support for that and traditional Jewish support for that. But that also means, though, that after 40 days, a traditional Jew would not want to abort because it is not a full person. And remember, Judaism is mainly thinking about under the law, legal requirements, and how you're dealing with this legally. So until birth, until the child breathes its first breath, it's not a person in terms of legal rights and things like that and where there would be punishment based on whether that was a full person. However, after 40 days, the fertilized egg now has human status, you could say. is no longer, quote, mere fluid in traditional Judaism, and therefore traditional Jews are also pro-life and would be against abortion after 40 days as well. But what she's saying, just remember, though, with Judaism, it's not so much a philosophical issue as much as it is a legal issue in terms of dealing with individuals when they are full persons or not under the law. If you just search online for the fetus in Jewish law, the subtitle to the says it all by Dr. Fred Rosner, does a fetus have the same legal status as a person? And that's primarily what's being discussed there. All right, we'll be right back with Jonathan McClatchy.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we have successfully connected with our guest, Jonathan McClatchy, in England, Christian writer, speaker, debater. He holds a bachelor's degree with honors in forensic biology, master's degree in evolutionary biology, second master's degree in medical and molecular bioscience, currently a PhD student in cell biology and an avid proponent of the scientific theory of intelligent design. He's done many radio debates and has also discussed and debated issues regarding atheism and Islam. And interestingly, the first call we got from a father wanted to know how to explain the Trinity to his 13-year-old. Jonathan has also debated Muslim scholar Dr. Shabir Ali on the doctrine of the Trinity versus the Islamic concept of Tawhid, God's unity. Hey, Jonathan, sorry we had a hard time connecting. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Jonathan, just to jump right in, what's the difference between intelligent design as a scientific theory and simply believing that God created the universe?
Sure. Well, the belief that God created the universe is really concerned with ontology. What is the source of being? Whereas intelligent design really is the quest for detecting the products of design in the world. So intelligent design is predicated upon the standard principles of scientific methodology. When we're investigating the past, we employ a method called the abductive historical method, which can be described as, or it can otherwise be called, the inference to the best explanation for multiple competing hypotheses. And basically, when you're trying to construct the past, we want to look for causes which are known from our experience to produce the types of effects we're trying to explain. And so when we find certain features in the realm of biology, but also in other realms, such as at the level of cosmic fine-tuning and so on, but my particular expertise is in biology, when we're looking at the information-bearing properties of DNA and RNA and so forth, information in every realm of experience, whether we find information in the form of the paragraphs of a book or in a hieroglyphic inscription or what have you, it uniformly traces its source back to a rational, conscious, deliberative agent. And so the intelligent design argument basically suggests that the intelligent design is a warranted inference from the biological evidence. Intelligent design doesn't necessarily compel one to embrace theism or Christian theism, but it does, I think, provide part of the cumulative case for theism, and more specifically Christian theism.
All right, Jonathan, you've been a Christian since 1996. When you came to the Lord, was there a major intellectual component to that of reasoning and trying to figure things out? Or did a lot of these other questions come up along your spiritual journey?
Well, in 1996, I was only 7 years old, so...
Got it. Yeah, as we met, I was trying to get to chronology. I thought, you're probably pretty young there, but I didn't know exactly your age. So that partially explains things. Go ahead.
But when I began getting interested in these sorts of questions, when I entered my university program in 2000, I began my undergraduate program in 2007 in forensic biology at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And I was confronted with the engineering prowess and grandeur of macromolecular machines. And it often baffled me as an undergraduate in studying the world of molecular biology, how anyone could go through a four-year university-level program in biology and come out an atheist at the other end, because the evidence seemed to be so compelling. The way that macromolecular machines are comprised of well-crafted components which work together and interact in an extraordinary way that just evidences engineering prowess at its finest. And just the irreducible complex nature of macromolecular machines, how you need multiple sub-functions in order to perform overall functions within the cell, and just the amount of information necessary to specify new protein folds and so on. And intelligent design kind of became my original interest within the broader discipline of apologetics. But I branched out since then. As you mentioned, I'm also interested in Islam, and that grew out of my interaction with Muslims during my undergraduate days. And I'm also interested in defending the New Testament and the resurrection in particular.
Mm. And where are you doing your PhD work now, Jonathan?
I'm currently in the northeast of England in a city called Newcastle.
Got it. And which university?
University of Newcastle.
Okay, got it. Obviously, there are a ton of questions I want to ask about intelligent design and why people can look at the evidence and still be atheists. A lot to discuss with you, but let me get your take on one Islamic-related issue first.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a lot over the years, popular articles about Islam, and I'll always use the term radical Islam in quotes for two reasons. One is to say that it is a genuine expression of Islam. This violent stream that we see is an expression that has historic and theological roots within Islam and can legitimately be called Islam. Yet I recognize the hundreds of millions of Muslims that would reject this and the many Muslim theologians and leaders that would reject this and say it's an abuse of the Quran and the life of Muhammad, etc. And therefore, to separate radical Muslims from other Muslims, I'll use quotes, but still say it is a true expression of Islam. I did a little Twitter poll yesterday. 79% of the people answered yes. Is radical Islam a true expression of Islam? So just in the minute or so we have now before the break, A, is it a true expression of Islam? And B, is it the only true expression of Islam?
Great questions. I think it certainly is a valid expression of Islam. I mean, it's certainly very consistent with the classical principles of hermeneutics for interpreting the Quran. With the Quran works somewhat differently from the way we interpret the Bible. So when we're interpreting the Quran, we need to abide by the so-called doctrine of abrogation, which is we're told about in the Quran in Surah Al-Baqarah, the second chapter of the Quran, verse 106, and also Surah 16, verse 101. Tells us that if there's any contradiction between surahs and between ayahs or verses, which are part of surahs or chapters, and if there's any difference between the different Quranic revelations, then the only question you want to ask is what came later, and that abrogates the earlier revelations. And it seems that the later revelations, the ones revealed to Muhammad in the city of Medina, are more violent and so forth than the Meccan surahs, which were revealed during the earlier part of Muhammad's career. Muhammad, between 610 and 622, lived in the city of Mecca. And in 622, he was forced to flee to Yathrib, which he later renamed Medina. And he spent the last decade of his life there until he died in 632. And of course, there's also the conquest of Mecca there as well. And as you progress throughout Muhammad's life, you see a change in the nature of the Quranic revelations. They become more aggressive and instruct Muslims to subjugate and oppress non-Muslims. So yes, certainly I think that the ISIS expression of Islam is a valid and defensible expression of Islam. Is it the only valid expression of Islam? Well, I would contend that we have to be very careful. I mean, there are many Muslims who would not do anything that the ISIS and any of the crimes that ISIS would perpetrate.
I'll tell you what, I gotta jump in. I appreciate the thorough answer. Gotta jump in. Gotta break. Friends, I'm opening the phone lines. If you have a question for my guest on intelligent design, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. Visit AskDrBrown.org. Check out this week's special resource offer.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. I'm speaking with Christian debater, writer, speaker, apologist, Jonathan McClatchy. We're going to be focusing on intelligent design, but Jonathan's also focused on atheism and Islam as well. So we were just talking about Islam before the break. So, Jonathan, again, appreciate the depth of research that you've given regarding Islam as well. Why do you say that, and I agree with you, by the way, I fully agree with you, but why do you say that many Muslims, including Muslim theologians, scholars, differ with the radical, violent interpretation of Islam as seen by ISIS and Al-Qaeda? Is it simply that they become humanistic, that they've imbued Western values, or is this a historic tradition they can trace as well?
I think that they are influenced in large measure by modern Western values. I mean, the modern Western way of interpreting the Quran is you let the passages you like reinterpret the passages which you don't like so much. And so there are passages in the Quran and in the Hadith which can be interpreted in view of a peace-loving paradigm, if you will. But there are also passages which ISIS and other groups would use to justify their actions. And the classical way of interpreting the Quran, the one pioneered by Muhammad himself and the one adopted by the great Quranic commentators, including Ibn Kathir, who is widely regarded by Sunni Muslims as the greatest Quranic commentator of all time, is in view of the doctrine of abrogation, where you let the later chapters abrogate the earlier chapters. The Quran, you know, Surah Al-Tawbah, the ninth chapter of the Quran, is particularly violent. And Surah Al-Tawbah, or the ninth chapter of the Quran, is purportedly the last revelation given to Muhammad just before he dies in 632. The Quranic revelations, of course, were delivered piecemeal between December of 609 through to 632. Muhammad himself was born in 570, and the revelations progressively get more violent. And Surah Al-Tawbah can be considered Muhammad's, almost like Muhammad's last marching orders, if you will, before his death. And you asked, are there other valid expressions of Islam? Sure. There seems to be three stages of jihad that we find going throughout Muhammad's life. Where first you have self-jihad, and your listeners may have heard of the doctrine of taqiyya, which is basically a principle of deception, which is taught in the Quran. And I think it's Surah 355 and Surah 16, verse 101, if I remember correctly, which is basically the idea that you can deceive people if by telling the truth you would put yourself or the Muslim community in jeopardy. And this seems to have been practiced by Muhammad himself. For example, there's a text in Al-Tabari's history where some of the Quraishi leaders, including Abu Jahl and so on, were went to a meeting with Muhammad's uncle called Abu Talib at Abu Talib's home. And Abu Talib, of course, was the leader of Muhammad's clan. And they were there for the purpose of talks of truce. And Muhammad basically asked them to become Muslims. And he says, by taking the Shahada, the all of Arabia will submit to you, and you will rule over the non-Arabs. The non-Arabs weren't threatening him at this time, and he's already plotting to rule over them. But behind that's taking place behind closed doors. Whereas out in his public ministry, you have texts revealed like Surah 109, which basically the gist of it is, you know, I have my religion, you have yours. Let's all just live together in harmony. So there's the first stage of jihad, which is stealth jihad, and then it moves on later in Muhammad's career to defensive jihad when they have a stronger presence, a stronger military presence. And then later they have commands for offensive and defensive jihad for
And by the way, in the second hour, interestingly, I've got a professor coming on who wants to talk about the origins and growth of jihad. All right, we'll turn our focus to intelligent design.
Fire we please, stand in the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. I'm speaking with Christian apologist Jonathan McClatchy. Two master's degrees with biology focus, now working on his PhD at the University of Newcastle in England on cell biology. There's a ton that we could obviously talk about with regard to Islam, with regard to atheism. I want to focus in on intelligent design, and specifically a first question, Jonathan, when it ties in with atheism. I was flying somewhere in the States one day, and the fellow next to me headed up a school that just worked with PhD science students on the West Coast. So it was kind of the elite of the elite. And he explained that he was an atheist, very, very cordial, wasn't hostile in any way, happy to talk to me as a believer. And he said, when you look through the different sciences and you get to biologists, it's unbelievably high percentage of atheists among them, you know, over 90%, at least in the States, if I recall what he was saying, as if the evidence is so compelling that that's the only logical conclusion. Whereas with my scientific ignorance, and again, knowing what it is to master a field, I'm quite ignorant of scientific studies beyond the major talking points. It baffles me. I don't understand how someone can study the cell and not come away recognizing intelligent design. I don't understand how someone could look at DNA and RNA and not conclude that there has to be intelligent design. So you've been on the inside of this. You've studied with top scholars and professors. Why do you think so many scientists, not all, not nearly all, but why do you think so many end up being atheistic? Is it simply a worldview that they're imposing on things? Is it evidence that I'm missing or not understanding?
I think it's probably to do with the fact that Darwinism rules the roost, if you will, in the academy. And students, as they attend their undergraduate programs and later pursue graduate programs, they are fed this theory of evolution by natural selection, and really told that it explains the appearance or the illusion of design without recourse to a designer. Richard Dawkins, of course, the famous Oxford zoologist, has said that evolution is a study of, or biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And he basically argues that that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. The late William Provine, who very tragically died recently of a brain tumor, famous philosopher of science, he said that Darwinism is the greatest engine for atheism ever devised. And so people are exposed to this idea of Darwinism, the idea that we are the result of a fundamentally stochastic process, based on chance and necessity, where there's no design, there's no foresight, there's no intrinsic teleology driving the process. And so the natural conclusion is atheism. It's to many people, it seems that the natural conclusion is atheism, and so that is the road they pursue. I think that if you really look closely at the world of the cell and look for explanations of the types of systems that we find in biology, I think that the scientific literature really comes out short in terms of finding plausible naturalistic scenarios by which these sorts of macromolecular machines could have come about. And one has to always distinguish, I think, between pattern and process, and often people get confused because they think the evidence for the proposition of common ancestry is evidence for the efficacy of the neo-Darwinian mechanism. Now, I think there's reason to question the proposition of common ancestry, but even if common ancestry is valid and correct, it doesn't entail logically that the mechanism of neo-Darwinism explains the appearance of design without recourse to a designer.
All right, so what would you say are the biggest questions that an atheistic worldview, an atheistic scientific approach, cannot adequately answer in any rational way?
The origin of life would be the most obvious example, because there simply is no naturalistic explanation of the origin of life. I mean, the whole field of the origin of life research is at an impasse. There's a lot of funding has been poured into it. There's a lot of time and research has been put into studying the question of the origin of life, and nothing. All of the materialistic explanations for the origin of life fall short at a number of hurdles. In particular, explaining the origin of the biological information necessary to get life started. You know, the hereditary molecules of DNA and RNA are predicated upon biological information. And by information, I mean not merely Shannon information. Shannon information was defined by a famous mathematician in the 20th century called Claude Shannon, who basically defined information as reduced uncertainty. So the more the greater the reduction in uncertainty, the more Shannon information content you possess. Whereas we're talking about, when we look at the realm of biology, we're talking about not mere Shannon information, but specified complex information. And by specified complex information, I mean information that's not only immensely improbable, and by improbable, I mean so improbable that it exhausts the probabilistic resources at one's disposal, but it also is specified and it conforms to some independently given pattern. So to take an analogy or an illustration, take an ATM machine, right? There's 10,000 possible ways of dialing in a four-digit number that's specific to your, and only one of those is specific to your bank card. And so you have this, you're searching for this tiny needle in an enormous haystack. And if you only have three attempts for the bank lock shred of your account, then that's the probabilistic resources. And given those probabilistic resources, it's immensely more likely that a random search for the correct PIN number will fail. And likewise, we have a similar situation going on when trying to explain the origin of biological information.
Yeah, obviously we could plunge into each of these more deeply, but I hope our listeners are able to digest the details which you're presenting with clarity. What about the question of the origin of the universe, the origin of matter? Again, just looking at this in a simplistic way, it boggles my mind that someone would not recognize, okay, if matter exists, it had to come from somewhere. Even Stephen Hawking's saying, well, gravity created the universe, without the question of where does gravity come from, the idea of nothing creating everything. Am I oversimplifying things, or does that present a real philosophical scientific issue? Where does matter come from? And if you have gases, where does this come from? Does that present a philosophical and scientific question?
Sure, it most definitely does. The why there is something rather than nothing is a question that has perplexed philosophers for a long time. And there's a few different versions of the cosmological argument. The Kalam cosmological argument, which is the one that has been made very famous by the likes of Dr. William Lane Craig and others, is to say that premise one, everything which begins to exist has a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist. Conclusion, therefore, the universe had a cause. And we can say certain things about that cause. It must be transtemporal, spaceless, and immaterial. Moreover, it must be personal, because if you have an eternal set of necessary and sufficient conditions, then the effect is there. The only way that you can have an eternal cause producing a temporal effect is if you have a personal agent that has the ability to freely choose between options. And moreover, that cause must be immensely intelligent, and I would derive that from the exquisite fine-tuning of the laws of physics. And the premise of the Kalam cosmological argument that the universe began to exist is not only supported by scientific evidence, but it's also supported by philosophical arguments. And that an actual infinite of temporal units leads you into all sorts of mathematical problems. And another version of the cosmological argument is the Leibnizian cosmological argument, which doesn't even require that the universe began to exist in order to justify the theistic conclusion. Basically, it only argues that the universe is contingent, and so the universe must be the result of some non-contingent entity. and basically argues that the best explanation for that non-contingent entity is God.
Yeah, and when I've heard the arguments presented, Jonathan, they've been so self-evident, they seem so rational, that I gave a presentation once to young people. I was asked to discuss some of these issues, Christian high school kids, and I said, there's the old dictum, I think, therefore I am. I said, well, my dictum is I am, therefore God exists. R.C. Sproul says, look at a shoe. The fact that a shoe exists, that anything exists, points to the fact that something had to bring it into existence, all the more when it is the wonder of life and the wonder of a human being. I've got a few more minutes with my guest, Christian apologist Jonathan McClatchy. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. Having a delightful time speaking with Christian apologist Jonathan McClatchy, two master's degrees in biology, technical subjects within biology, now working on a PhD at the University of Newcastle. And Jonathan, someone asked off the air, are there systematic parameters for teaching intelligent design? So we have this debate in America, of course. Some of it is just considered to be religious obscurantism and fundamentalism and wanting creationism taught in schools as an alternative to Darwinian evolution. And then others say, well, we're not advocating creationism because you could argue that that is a religious subject. We're simply arguing intelligent design, purely scientific parameters. Can you give a good reason why someone would not want, aside from just philosophical dogma, can you give a good reason why we shouldn't teach in a systematic way intelligent design as an alternative to Darwinian evolution? And if you agree it should be taught, what are the parameters? How would it be taught scientifically?
I think we need to be careful because intelligent design currently has a minority, it's a growing minority, but a minority nonetheless of the scientific community that backs it. And so, since intelligent design is not the quote-unquote mainstream or consensus view among biologists, I would say that we should hold off and at least pushing it into the public school curriculum, because I don't think, we don't want to jump the gun. We want to do science in the way that science is always done, and work on intelligent design as a scientific theory and develop it as a rigorous scientific research program. And eventually, as we become more and more dominant within the scientific community, then eventually we might see intelligent design trickle down into the public school science curriculum. As I personally think that public schools should nonetheless teach the strengths and weaknesses of theory of scientific theories which are currently taught, including neo-Darwinian theory. There is a lot of controversy about the efficacy and adequacy of the various evolutionary mechanisms in the scientific literature. And so I think that that should be discussed freely and openly. And intelligent design, I think teachers should have the freedom to mention intelligent design and to mention that they subscribe to intelligent design and even mention some of the arguments for intelligent design. But I don't think that it should be mandated. I don't think I don't think we can expect teachers to necessarily treat it fairly if we were to mandate intelligent design in the public school curriculum in any case.
All right. And if you were teaching it in a scientific way, what not in an apologetic way where you want everyone ultimately to know the one true God through his son, Jesus, but if you were teaching this in a scientific way only, what would your end goal be in teaching intelligent design to students?
Well, I would try to articulate the methods that intelligent design proponents use to detect and infer design in biology. I would look at some of the principles and concepts that has been developed by the intelligent design community, including specified complexity and irreducible complexity and And looking at some of the research that's been done at the Biologic Institute, for example, which is an intelligent design laboratory based in Washington State. And so that would be my approach.
Got it. All right. There's so much more we could discuss, Jonathan. We'll have to connect again on the air. But I'm going to ask you a very difficult to do something very difficult in 2 minutes. What were your principal arguments when you debated Shabir Ali in favor of the Trinity over against Islamic doctrine of Tawhid? Can you summarize those for us in maybe 2 minutes or less?
Sure. My first argument was that the doctrine of Tawhid has its own internal problems. So I pointed to various texts in the Quran which support the notion that Allah is the sole creator of life, that creation is the sole divine prerogative. And I pointed to passage in Surah 19, which basically says that the Spirit was the one who bestowed upon Mary a boy. And this also dovetails with Surah 66:12, where the Holy Spirit is said to be breathed by Allah into through Mary's private parts, and that was what brought about the birth of Jesus. And there's also other texts which say that the Spirit was breathed into Adam, that's what brought Adam to life, and so on. And there's a text in Surah 33 which suggests that or Surah 32, that suggests that the Spirit is involved generally in the creation of human life. I also pointed out that according to the Quran, in Surah 352 and Surah 61:14, the disciples of Jesus were Muslims, and so then I built an historical argument for the disciples being Trinitarian. I drew primarily on Paul and upon Mark, and they argued that Paul was Trinitarian, or at least he had a very high Christology from the deity of Christ, and there's also some evidence that might suggest he's Trinitarian, and that he was approved of by the Jerusalem Church. I made an argument for that. I also made an argument for Mark being based upon the teaching of Peter, and so I suggested that Mark, because you can demonstrate the Trinity from the first three chapters of Mark. We have the deity of Christ presented in verses 2 and 3, when Isaiah 40 is applied to Jesus. Then you have the distinction of the Father, Son, and Spirit in the baptism narrative, also in chapter 1. And then in chapter 3, you were told that you can blaspheme against the Holy Spirit, which suggests that the Holy Spirit is, in fact, deity. And then my third argument was that the Injil, or the Gospel, is Trinitarian. And then I basically presented my arguments for that, because the Quran actually affirms the Injil. And so if the Injil, which is in the possession of the Christians of Muhammad's time, is Trinitarian, the Muslims have a problem.
Got it. Yeah, well, another time we'll have to find out how Shabir Ali responded and how the audience took it. But, Jonathan, I commend you for the work that you are doing, and trust that the Lord is going to continue to use you to put mind, heart, and spirit together to touch your generation in England and beyond. So we'll connect again and look forward to chatting face-to-face again one of these days.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, friends, I did not get to calls just because of the limited time I had with my guest, but I'm going to take a couple of calls right at the top of the next hour, all right? And my next guest, Tony Costa, is going to discuss with us Islamic issues and the meaning and origin of jihad. So stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. I'll take some calls on the other side of the hour. If you're losing me on the air, fear not. Got a great guest. Another hour more. Just go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. And when you just click on Listen Live, it'll take you right to the broadcast. You can continue to listen on your cell phone. You can listen on your tablet, your computer, and we'll continue the discussion. 866-34-TRUTH. Ultimately, as I said yesterday, the great, great answer to the problems in America and the world, very simple, revival in the church. Revival in the church. God's people being awakened, coming alive. We've got two terrific books and a CD that'll stir your heart, all for $20, a $40 value. Normally would be postage as well on top of that. Just $20, we're paying the postage for the book I co-authored with Pastor John Kilpatrick, The Fire That Never Sleeps, with Keys to Personal Awakening, the Revival Answer Book, giving you wisdom and discernment in the midst of revival, and Holy Desperation, a message to stir your heart to go after God. To order, go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, to me, it seems to be the only intelligent option. We have been intelligently designed. Jihad, what is the origin of it, and how deeply ingrained is it in Muslim theology and ideology?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm about to have a fascinating discussion with Christian apologist Tony Costa, and we're going to focus on the subject of jihad. We'll talk about radical Islam and true Islam. If you've got a question for my guest, number to call 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I put out a question on Twitter yesterday: is radical Islam an expression of true Islam or a true expression of Islam? And out of those responding, 260-something people responding, we had 79% saying yes, 21% saying no. But I have no way, just glancing at that, to tell you what the demographics were. Was it uninformed Christians responding? Was it well-informed Christians? Was it uninformed Muslims? Was it well-informed Muslims? I don't know that. So I'm just giving you the public response to a poll. But I want to ask my guest a similar question. Tony's earned a BA and MA in the study of religion, biblical studies, and philosophy from the University of Toronto, received his PhD in the area of theology and New Testament studies from Radboud University in the Netherlands, and his area of expertise is biblical systematic theology, cults, the New Age movement, and comparative world religions with a specialization in Islam. With that introduction, Tony, welcome back to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure being with you again.
Appreciate it very much. All right, Tony, before we get into the discussion of jihad, I'm criticized on both sides for using the term radical Islam. And I will always use it when I'm writing about groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, etc. I say radical Islam because I'm convinced it is a true and valid expression of Islam based on the teachings of the Quran, the example of Muhammad, the Hadith, and even Muslim history. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, I recognize there are large numbers of Muslims, including theologians and scholars, who reject this and say it is an invalid interpretation. And that's why I'll use the term radical Islam. So I'm criticized by some who say it's the only expression of Islam and others who say it's not Islam at all. So what's your view on this? Just in the 2 minutes we have in this opening segment, is radical Islam a true expression of Islam? And if so, is it the only valid expression? What's your take?
Well, I think we have to define our terms. The word radical does come from a word that means to get to the root of something. And I think that when we get to the root of Islam itself, what defines Islam is the Quran, the Hadith, the Sira, what we call the Islamic text, which form the Sunnah, which is the pattern that Muslims ought to follow, imitating the Prophet Muhammad in Islam. And so my take is that when I look at the Quranic texts and the Hadith and all the other texts, they do clearly show that there is indeed a call to fight the unbelievers, to engage in jihad, to subjugate unbelievers and bring them under the banner of Islam. And I think part of the problem here, Michael, is that we tend to look at Islam purely from a religious context, and Islam is not just religious. Islam is political at the same time. There is no separation of mosque and state in Islam. It's all one. And I think that's the difficulty. We have to remember Islam is both political and religious at the same time.
Right. So Muhammad was first a spiritual leader, then a political leader, then a military leader. And as someone said with regard to Islam, in Islam, it's not so much that religion is a part of life, but that life is a part of religion. So when you have a legal system, when you have whole countries coming into under the domination of Islam, obviously it does color things. All right, we come back. Let's talk about the concept of jihad. What are the origins of it? How did it develop? What is its meaning today? I'm speaking with Tony Costa, professor of apologetics with the Toronto Baptist Seminary. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Speaking with Tony Costa, professor of apologetics with the Toronto Baptist Seminary, also teaches with the School of Continuing Studies at the University of Toronto in the area of world religions, and serves as an adjunct professor with Heritage College and Seminary in Cambridge, Ontario, and Providence Theological Seminary in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Tony, that sounds like me. I'm an adjunct or visiting prof at four different seminaries, and I've got my home school as well. But it's nice to be able to do that. All right, I've had a caller on hold for a while from the last hour. He's got a related question regarding Islam, radical Islam. So I want to take this one call, Tony, and then we'll start to talk about jihad, all right? Okay, Russell in Damascus, Maryland. Welcome to the Line of Fire. What's your question regarding radical Islam?
Yes, I have a question that I think on this subject. I'm a Christian, and I've been raised a Christian. I've been Christian all my life, but I have read the Quran. I'd like to make a statement about what I understand jihad to be, and is the term radical Islam appropriate as a description, or does it slander Islam? I do speak some Arabic because my background is Syrian, and Islam, I understand, means surrender, and that my understanding is that Muslims are urged, are called to surrender their own personal will to the righteous, perfect, holy will of God, or Allah, God. And when they do that, I mean, that is personal jihad, but it's further my understanding that there's godly jihad, where the person totally surrenders his will to the holy will of God in his life. And of course, Jesus did that perfectly. But if a person, there's also satanic or demonic jihad, if a person surrenders his will to the will of Satan. And so that we can, you know, God distinguishes between the godly and the ungodly. And it's my understanding that there's godly jihad and then the jihad of these terrorists, which is clearly ungodly or demonic jihad. Now, that's my understanding. I'd like to get, you know, your response and the response of your guest, Tony.
Sure thing. Yeah, I'll go right to Tony. And I appreciate you taking the time to read the Quran as a Christian. So, Tony, your response.
Yes, the word jihad is an Arabic word which means to strive and to struggle, and some Muslim interpreters have taken jihad to mean something of a struggle of a spiritual nature, of fighting sin and lust and these types of things. But the Hadith literature, which is the deeds and words of Muhammad, is very clear that the jihad that is the greatest of all is to fight and die in the way of Allah. The Quran says, "Fasabil Allah." And chapter 9 of the Quran in particular, the last revealed chapter, Surah 9, chapter 9, is very clear that the marching orders of Muhammad, the last marching orders, were to fight the idolaters, slay them wherever you find them. Chapter 9, verse 29, calls on Muslims to wage war against the people of the book, who are Jews and Christians, who do not believe in Allah and His Messenger, and to fight them until they submit or surrender. One of the last words Muhammad uttered, Michael, before his death, he said, "I have been commanded by Allah to fight the people until they say there is no God but Allah, and I am His messenger." And so it's very clear from the Hadith literature that jihad, the jihad of the sword, if you will, is the greatest jihad in Islam.
Yeah, thank you, Russell. Thank you for the question, Tony. Much appreciation on the answer there. All right, so we know the word Islam is not primarily peace. People think, well, isn't that related to the word shalom and salam alaikum? You greet someone like that. Yes, but we all know that the form of the noun coming from right. a particular verbal form means submission. So it's Correct. Individual submission to Allah. But then the Muslim version of the Great Commission is to bring the entire world under submission to Allah, which includes Sharia law, as you were saying, is both political and spiritual. So the origin of jihad, the concept of it, explain it historically, sure. ideologically, and then where it brings us today.
Sure. Everything in Islam is patterned after the model of Muhammad. And the ministry of Muhammad began in 610 AD, where he received the call by Allah through the angel Gabriel to become a prophet. And from 610 to 622, Muhammad received what we call today the Meccan surahs, the Meccan chapters. And while he was in Mecca, he was in the minority. And these chapters tend to be very amicable, very peaceful. They're tolerant and so forth. But from 622 to 632, Muhammad went into Medina. And there he began to receive the Medinan surahs, or chapters. And there you find a shift. There's a change. The tone changes. There is calls to fight the enemies of Allah, to subjugate the unbelievers, and so forth. And in Islam, there is the principle of abrogation, which claims that the later surahs, that is, the Medinan surahs, abrogate the previous surahs, the Meccan surahs. And so the Islamic argument is that the later surahs abrogate all the peaceful verses. So when Muslims say things like, there is no compulsion in religion, which is quoting from Surah 2, what they don't usually tell you is that that verse has been abrogated by Surah 9, verse 5, to slay the idolaters wherever you find them until they submit and so forth. So it's important to understand that, yes, there are peaceful verses in the Quran, but these are Meccan, and they are understood to be abrogated by the later Medinan surahs. But when Muslims are in the minority, as they are in the United States right now, in Canada and the West, Muslims will imitate Muhammad in quoting these peaceful verses. However, the ultimate aim of Islam, according to the Quran, is for them to be uppermost, that they must become uppermost, and that eventually establish the Islamic hegemony throughout the earth.
Right. Now, it's interesting. I had Jonathan McClatchy on with me from England in the first hour, and we were discussing intelligent design. He's a Christian apologist as well, getting his PhD in biology in England. But he's also done Islamic debates, debated Shabir Ali one time, and he's also engaged in atheist apologetics. So I asked him a couple of quick questions about Islam. What's fascinating is the degree of harmony between your answer and his answer. Now, here I'll play the Muslim's advocate for a moment. This is just the way Christians are approaching it to explain why they believe Muslims are so violent. But Muslims know that this is really not the way it works, this whole doctrine of abrogation, and that the later surahs, if they contradict the earlier ones, you go with the later ones. You're just that Muslims really don't believe that. That's just what you're saying. Again, dumb objection, but some are necessarily going to think that because you are a Christian apologist. So how deeply embedded is this in historic Islamic interpretation of the Quran?
Very, very deeply embedded. In fact, we get these right from the Islamic scholars that the Muslims are encouraged to look up to. Ibn Kathir is probably one of the most respected commentators on the Quran, and he argues very clearly for the concept of abrogation. Even Shabir Ali, my friend Shabir Ali, understands the concept of abrogation, has actually used it in some of my debates with him. And so it's the Islamic scholars that are saying this. These aren't the Christian apologists that are coming up with this. These are coming from bona fide commentaries, respected authorities in Islam, a scholar from Al-Azhar University in Cairo, Egypt, which is considered the leading university in Sunni Islam when it comes to Islamic exegesis. So these very arguments that we're putting out there, we're getting them right from the scholars that Muslims are supposed to look up to.
Yeah, and what may surprise a lot of Christians is the thoroughgoing intellectual nature of Islam. When I was reading Arabic texts in grad school, reading the Quran with Quranic commentaries, I was struck by how similar it felt to reading the Bible with rabbinic commentators, and then in Islam, because it's a legally based, a law-based religion, as Judaism is, the halakhic discussions, legal discussions in Judaism, comparing them to Islam, and then apologetic literature. So even though we might think of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and just think of them as kind of barbarians and living in caves, you know, the Taliban and that kind of thing, and anti-education, there's actually a very rich intellectual tradition in Islam. So there are laws of interpretation and esteemed commentaries that you're simply saying this is what the authentic tradition says.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. And anyone could research that for themselves just by getting these commentaries. We call them in Arabic, they're called the tafsir. There's Ibn Kathir, al-Jalalain, and al-Tirmidhi, and there's al-Tabari, and a whole host of them. And when you read them, they all argue the same argument on abrogation.
Right. So again, friends, this is saying that if you have two verses that contradict each other, let's say one says love your enemies and the other says kill your enemies. Well, which one was revealed to Muhammad last? Then that's the one you go by. So we'll come back to this, and I want to focus specifically on issues regarding jihad. But the big question would be, in your judgment, Tony, having studied this for years and I'm sure interacted with Muslim leaders, are Muslim leaders deceiving us worldwide when they say this is not authentic Islam and we renounce that? Are they deceiving us, or have they been westernized? Or is there another stream of Islamic tradition that they can point to for their viewpoint? We'll take your calls as well on Islam with my guest, Professor Tony Costa.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Professor Tony Costa, Christian apologist, also teaches world religions with a specialization in Islam. 866-34-TRUTH. I'll grab a couple of calls in the next few minutes as well. Tony, let our readers know if they want to follow your work or if you have any books of interest. Let our listeners know more about you.
Yeah, they can always go to my website. It's tonycosta.webs.com. That's tonycosta.webs.com. Most of my literature is posted there and some of my published materials.
And you've got a recent book?
Well, the book that I came out with is my doctoral dissertation, which was published, Worship and the Risen Jesus in the Pauline Letters. So that's my most recent book, but I'm hoping to come out with more forthcoming literature.
Awesome. Yeah, it's always a challenge to do all the teaching, do all the ministry,
yes,
and get the books coming out as well. But yeah, we'd love to hear more from you in book form. Tony, so my question, when Muslim leaders, respected Muslim leaders, say ISIS is not Islam, Al-Qaeda is not Islam, Taliban, they're not truly representing Islam, are they lying to us? Are they pointing to a different valid Islamic tradition through the centuries?
Well, the problem here is that whatever ISIS does, you'll notice they always keep backing it up with the Quran, the Hadith,
yes,
and so forth.
Yeah.
The problem with what Muslims are telling us today is there is a concept known as taqiyya in the Quran, and in the Quran, the doctrine of taqiyya says that Muslims are permitted to lie to the kafir, who are the unbelievers. And so in Islam, there is the principle that when Muslims feel threatened by the unbelievers or the infidels, the Quran says that they are permitted to lie or to lead astray the unbelievers. Now, we have to understand that according to the Quran in chapter 7, there's a story there where when Allah or God created Adam, he brought forth all his progeny, that is all his descendants, including you and me and everyone else in this planet, and basically entered into a covenant with them whereby they acknowledged that Allah was their only God and their only master. And so from the point of view of the Quran, we're all born Muslims. All human beings are Muslims by birth. But Muhammad taught that when someone becomes a Jew or a Christian or another religious affiliation, they've been basically led astray by their parents or other people. So from the Islamic perspective, all human beings are Muslims, and the greatest sin against Allah is not just associating partners with him, but it's also the sin of unbelief. That is to say, that people who should know better to submit to their creator, they are considered kafir or unbelievers, enemies of Allah. And therefore, to lie to an enemy or an infidel in the Quran is wholly permissible. However, there are Muslims who are influenced by Western values in the USA and Canada and so forth, who are convinced that democracy is the way to go. And some of these Muslims will say, well, no, Sharia law is compatible, but it's not compatible. And then there are other Muslims who are reformists. They want to reform Islam. And I really do applaud the cause, but the problem is you cannot reform a system that is believed to be perfect and sent down perfectly by Allah. The Quran says that that in chapter 5, verse 3, that Allah has given you Islam. He has perfected for you your religion of Islam. And so you cannot reform something that is perfect by definition. And they do try to compare it with the Protestant Reformation. And it's a poor analogy because when the Protestant Reformation said, let's go back ad fontes, to the fountain, to the sources, what did it do? It brought about a revival in the church where the Word of God was read, where the Word of God was translated. But when you go back to the sources of the Quran and Islam, what do you find? You have a return to jihad. You have a return to... That's why many converts, Michael, in the West, if you notice, many of these converts go out to fight with ISIS. They become very radical. And why is this so? Well, when you go to the sources of Islam, which are the texts, there are these texts in there that call you to be faithful to Allah by fighting and being slain in the cause of Allah to inherit paradise.
Yeah. All right. Friends, chew on the evidence, but you're hearing some strong arguments. Let's grab one more call. We'll go to Calgary, Alberta. So we'll connect Canadian with Canadian. Nick, welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have something to add into it, and I think it's good that you have Tony on because I think he'll probably be able to add some chapter and verse, so to speak, behind it. But a lot of times when people tend to, there's this move in the culture to try to dismiss violent Islamic behavior and sort of equate Islam with Christianity in a sense, and they'll usually try to point to something like the Crusades or something like that. And I always just try to point out to people, I never really hear anybody make this argument. Look, I think that Muhammad's direct followers, the caliphs that followed after him, understood what he taught better than anybody now, you know, 1,400 years later. And they expanded the Islamic empire over 100 years or so. Tony could correct this, but they took over more land than the Roman Empire. And it wasn't because they had a bunch of Billy Grahams working for them and they were just really good preachers. They killed anyone who refused to convert or put them under a tax system. And whereas Christianity took 1,000 years before the Crusades happened, in direct contradiction to what Jesus taught, his followers went to their deaths. They didn't put anyone to death. And I don't know, maybe you guys can add something to that because most people don't point that out.
Yeah. Tony?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with our caller. The Crusades, of course, that's a topic for another day, but the Crusades were really a response to the Islamic expansion throughout the Middle East and North Africa and into Spain and Portugal. And so the Crusades, from a political point of view, a sociological point of view, was a response to that expansion. We can debate the religious items at another time. But he's absolutely right. Islam moved rapidly after the death of Muhammad under the caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. And as I pointed out, they took over all of these bastions of early Christianity. They conquered the Byzantine kingdom by the time of the 15th century. All of Constantinople and all of Byzantium had fallen. They had taken North Africa, all of the Middle East. Persia fell. They took swaths of India, and they went as far as Spain. And so we have to ask the question, how did this this empire, which came out of the Arabian Peninsula, how did they conquer so much land and so quickly? And also, you may know this too, Michael, but the history of the United States, the very origins of the U.S. Navy were based on the attacks of the Barbary pirates that were attacking U.S. Vessels in the Mediterranean and demanding jizya from them, that is the special poll tax. And some of the founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and others, were very familiar with Islam and its attacks on its naval fleet. And this is one of the reasons why the United States had to create its naval force to protect itself against the Barbary pirates from North Africa who were Muslims.
So here we get some American history from my Canadian guest. Listen, I've got a few more minutes to be on with Tony, so I want to just grab those on the other side of the break and still talk through a few other issues relating to the subject of jihad. So stay right there. I won't be able to take any more calls, though, so I've got a few more questions for my guest, Professor Tony Costa. We'll give you his website again when he comes back. And as I've been saying yesterday, today, for many years before, the great key, the great solution to our nation's problems is a turning to God. And that begins with awakening in the church. My resources this week, two books and a CD at half price, and we're paying the postage, will really help spark revival, spiritual hunger, and discernment in your own heart and life. Go to my website, askdrbrown.org. You'll find out more information right there.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I am speaking with Professor Tony Costa, who teaches apologetics at the Toronto Baptist Seminary, as well as teaches at some other universities and seminaries on world religion. He's specialized in Islam in that regard. Tony, if we focus on the subject of jihad, you'll often hear Muslims today say it's something spiritual. It is about conquering sin. It is about personal spiritual struggles. It is not primarily a call to physical battle. And Muslims are not primarily called to physical battle unless there's an actual war that you're engaging in. What's your understanding of the doctrine of jihad and its history?
Well, the doctrine of jihad originates, of course, with Muhammad, with his calls to warfare. But again, if you investigate the Islamic texts, like the Hadith, it's very, very clear that when Muhammad spoke about jihad, he said one of his greatest desires, apparently, for Muhammad in the Hadith, he says that his desire was to die in the cause of Allah, be resurrected, die in the cause of Allah, be resurrected, and then die again. And so Muhammad's greatest desire, he said, was to die as a martyr in Allah's cause. Now, if that is the Prophet's desire, then what should his followers desire? Well, they should desire the same thing in imitation of the Prophet. So the modern explanation that jihad just simply means fighting with your carnal nature, fighting with your sin and struggling, I think just does not meet up with the evidence that we find in the Islamic text. The Islamic texts are very clear that jihad means struggling to fight in the way of Allah, to expand Allah's religion over the world.
And when you hear Quran chapter 5, verse 32, quote it, normally a little part is pulled out of it, as President Obama pulled it out at Cairo, ignoring the fact that it's quoting a Jewish tradition that was for the Jews, that whoever kills one soul is as if he killed the whole world, etc. They ignore the next verse, which talks about how to violently treat the unbeliever and those who, quote, do mischief in the land. When Muslims are quoting that, posting it on social media, have they read the Quran themselves, or is this just part of taqiyya?
I think it's part of taqiyya, Michael, because many Muslims are taught to memorize the Quran, at least in Arabic. They're very familiar with that, and you're absolutely right. And that passage, as you know, is taken right out of the Talmud.
Yep.
And so it's not even original to the Quran.
Yeah, I'm actually going to write an article on that, just assuming that many Christians don't know this. David Wood put out a great video about it yesterday that we linked to, explaining the justification in the Islamic mind for the attacks in Paris. And what's interesting, though, is in the Quran, the verses leading up to that are talking about Cain killing Abel. And that's actually the context for the quote in the Talmud, because the Hebrew speaks of bloods. The sound of your brother's bloods is crying out from the earth, based on which it is now deduced that if you kill one person, it's as if you killed the whole world, and conversely, save one person, it's as if you saved the whole world. So that's probably how it got included there, that Muhammad, from his Jewish sources, heard that in the context of Cain. Of course, it's not linked in the Quran, but that's how you get to it there in verse 32. But that was for the Jews. That's what Allah gave for the Jews, but not for the Muslims.
Correct. And also, Muhammad had a lot of contact with Jews in Medina, and a lot of contact. There was a large Jewish population there until he began to fight them and to butcher them. So Muhammad had a lot of access to Jewish information. That's why there are echoes of the Mishnah, the Talmud, the various rabbinic literatures are also quoted in the Quran, without credit, incidentally. They're just assumed that this is from Allah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there are even words that have come into Arabic through Aramaic, presumably through Jewish influence. Tony, we've got to run, but let's do this again, and let's talk another time about effective ways to witness to our Muslim neighbors. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Dr. Brown.
All right. That was Professor Tony Costa. Do a search online for Tony, C-O-S-T-A. He's got a lot of valuable information. We'll be right back.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is my joy at this time of the week to get my update, interact with Reverend James Robison. You've seen him for many years on Life Today. Maybe you've been at meetings where he's preached around America or in other nations. His great endeavor in recent years has now been the launching of The Stream, stream.org. I have the joy of writing an article or two or sometimes more for The Stream each week. You'll find tremendous columns, op-ed pieces, cutting-edge news, what's happening, but then a constant Christian perspective on this. So if you've not yet visited, please do visit The Stream. That is stream.org. James, welcome to The Line of Fire. Great to speak with you today.
Well, Doc, it's good to be with you. I appreciate you have another real good article on there talking about the fact that not all Muslims are terrorists, but most terrorists are Muslims. There's got to be some kind of a connection.
Yeah, I've had two scholars on with me today, both of whom have specialized in studying Islam, and they say without question you can trace this right back to the pages of the Quran and the life of Muhammad. James, there's an article getting a lot of attention on The Stream today by Faith McDonald, Scandal: U.S. Christian groups are prioritizing Muslim refugees over Christian ones. Here's why. What's going on, and why is that such a scandal?
Well, I think this is a fabulous article for people to read to just get insight as to how totally lopsided and out of sync with the reality and principles we're getting all over the world. And Christians are really becoming the target. It almost looks like in some ways some Christians are more like Christ, really serious about what the Father wants and what kingdom reality is. And it looks like the hatred and hostility and animosity has been poured out on those Christians as it was on Jesus. My prayer is that we will be wise enough to know that where we have the ability to affect policy, practices, laws, and the enforcement of those laws, that Christians will realize that that is a glorious freedom. And the fact that we have moved so far away from principled living and understanding, I think Christians' indifference and lack of participation in what freedom has offered them has really contributed to the demise of freedom and the targeting of Christians almost at random and deliberately because we have not been the light that pierces the darkness. And I think we better wake up. And this is just another example, a tremendously well-written article, letting people know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, and by the way, I have the article on the screen in front of me. It's hyperlinked throughout. That means that every point that Faith is making here, if you see the text coming up underlined or in blue, you click on that, that'll take you to a link supporting that or links of other articles. What should we do with our approach to the refugee crisis? One political candidate has basically said you can't take refugees in. Another said, well, let's take Christian refugees in. Many Christians are asking about this. On the one hand, if we knew for every 10 refugees that came in, one might be a terrorist, or out of every 100, one might be a terrorist, you can't open your borders to potential terrorists like that. Yet we know that multitudes are fleeing from terror, both Christian and Muslim. Is there an approach we should have to this?
Well, we're supposed to operate with compassion and wisdom, and we don't even correct and protect our own border situation. So we have proven that we are either refusing to step up or we don't even have the capability of doing it. So I think right now, wisdom certainly tells us to move very, very slowly and wisely, and we'd be better be very deliberate in anyone we do let in. And I think that it's just a very dangerous situation right now. We've illustrated that we're not very good at keeping out the ones who shouldn't be in. I think these are the kind of things that you have to really step back, come to the table of reason, and pound out the best approach. And you do not leave compassion out. You do not leave legitimate concern for others' well-being out. But you certainly do not allow to come in those individuals like a wolf to not only scatter the sheep, but slaughter them. Now, you just can't do it. A shepherd would never allow that to happen. And so sane-thinking people must find a way to prevent that, at the same time find a way to help them. Why aren't these Muslim countries, why doesn't Turkey, why don't some of the other countries, why didn't Jordan, why don't they take these Muslims in that are trying to escape from the horrors that are there? Where is all this family and interest in one another that the Muslims talk about, but not a single Muslim country will extend that freedom and that benefit of protection and safety, security and refuge to the people who claim to be of their own faith. It is absolute nonsense. I mean, they're pressing in on Israel to do more, and yet the border countries will not do anything for the people who profess the same faith. I do think that we can step up and really encourage and even insist that these people not just be forced on the Western world. It's almost as though they're trying to infiltrate like a Trojan horse with the intent of destroying or even diminishing the strength of the other nations in order to boost the Muslim strength. And that just simply, it just sounds totally insane to me that we don't come and reason together and really find an appropriate approach. What do you think about it? What's your feeling and suggestion?
Yeah, I'm tracking very similarly with you. First, the question about the Muslim world, I've asked that perpetually. Now, you do have the case that a couple of million Syrian refugees have flooded immediately south into Lebanon. That country is completely swelling with refugees there. They flooded into Iraq from Syria. You've got these massive refugee camps. In fact, we have grads from our ministry school serving in Kurdistan in northern Iraq, and suddenly in their backyard, there's this massive tent city of refugees to reach out to. This is completely different than, say, Saudi Arabia opening its borders and saying, hey, come and become part of our country, become citizens, become one with us, which is a logical thing. You speak the same language, you're the same culture, the same religious faith, as opposed to expecting Europe and the U.S. to do more. I just got back from Hungary, I was there 2 weeks ago, and they officially closed their borders. They said, we've taken in refugees, they don't want to be part of our society, they're not working to assimilate and be part of us. And Hungary was under Ottoman rule, under the Muslims, about 500-600 years ago, for 150 years. So they said, basically, we've been there and done this, and we're not going to do it again. One specialist told my friend in Hungary that he thinks Sweden is about to fall in the coming years because of the growing Islamic population and the weakness of the church there. But certainly, as the church, there are refugees needing to come here that churches can get involved with sponsoring. And there are plenty of Christian refugees that need to be sponsored. So on the church level, we can get involved. And on the government level, as much as there's a legitimate need, we've got to slow things down. I used the illustration yesterday that if you have, say, your daughter's got 10 friends, she wants to come over for a birthday sleepover, but one of them may have a deadly contagious disease. You cancel the sleepover until you find out who's got the disease. We have to do it. I agree with you. Wisdom requires us to. And unfortunately, not to bash our president, but once again, he's not leading the way in the right direction now.
But it really breaks your heart to hear a man that's supposed to be well-educated and is considered intelligent, and he certainly has a mouth that runs freely, expressing whatever he claims to believe. How in the world he can think so irrationally? I mean, it was almost his speech yesterday sounded like some rambling school kid that was just trying to talk his way into some kind of passing grade. It was just, if it hadn't been so tragic, it was laughable.
Yeah, I heard one commentator, a military commentator, saying that he was in a state of shock. He said it's one of the worst things that he ever heard. And especially when you have France saying, help us bring ISIS down there. This yeah. is outright, you help join together. Russia says, we'll help. And America is reluctant to help. It's very troubling.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the articles on the screen today, and I actually just now noticed this one. I think it might have been put up in the last little while, but it was talking about prayer, and it was an athlete referring to the fact that people were told and asked to pray for Paris and for France, but they told a football player he couldn't pray. And isn't that interesting that you're asked to pray on one hand, and then you're told not to pray on another hand? It's just pitiful. By the way, yeah. I hope people will read my article on the stream right now about the Trump's vicious attack on Carson and the people of Iowa and what it reveals. I really think it's important to see that because a person's explosive actions and their apparent out-of-control actions will tend to tell you what they do and how they respond when they're confronted or when they're challenged. And really, challenging is iron sharpening iron. And we all become keener if we don't hit head on. We can sharpen the blade. And that's the way we're supposed to meet. But when a person hits in a not only an abrasive fashion, but a very damaging fashion, you've got to wonder what he would do if he faced some real serious
yep.
pressure. How would he vent and how would he challenge his opponents? If it's character assassination and destruction, then he's operating just like the leftist media that tries to assassinate every noble character.
Yeah, in fact, if you've got just a couple more minutes, I've got that article on my screen here. I wanted to discuss that with you as well, just a couple more minutes on that. The article by James Robison, getting a lot of attention on the stream, is Trump's vicious attack on Ben Carson, this was last week, and the people of Iowa, whom he also attacked, what it reveals. So I want to get a little bit more wisdom on the political scene from our guest James Robison. When we come back, visit the stream. It is stream.org. Let it be your go-to news and commentary website. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Reverend James Robison, Life Today TV, and the website The Stream has been something launched now over the last year that is getting growing internet attention. Again, you can go there. You won't be confronted with all kinds of pop-up ads or unclean pictures. You'll get the latest news. You'll get Christian commentary and other wise conservative commentary, and then articles on apologetics as well. So it's a great place to get your news and to get grounded, to get strengthened as well. There's an article that James wrote, the Trump's vicious attack on Ben Carson and the people of Iowa. So he really went after Dr. Carson in the ugliest terms, pathological liar, compared him, or pathological temper, compared him to a child molester that can't change, called the people of Iowa stupid and garbage and other terms. And the thing that's crazy, James, is as he does this, you would think that his poll numbers should be dropping dramatically. And yet, so far, we're not seeing this. It's almost as if this fascination with a reality TV star who can go too far is bigger than ethics and wisdom. So what do we make of all of this?
Well, people are frustrated and they're angry. And we've got plenty of reasons to be angry and plenty of reasons to be frustrated. But the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God, James chapter 1 tells us. And although we have righteous indignation, we have what we almost could call a very holy and very meaningful anger in that it's justifiable, it still will not change things. And he is just tearing into anybody he disagrees with. It's a mockery. How in the world do you change a person's thinking when you belittle them and you try to destroy them, and you're talking about becoming a restoring factor and a healing factor in a nation that has been damaged deeply? It just reveals something about the nature of the man. And arrogance, pride goes before a fall. But frustrated people who are mad at political correctness, they're mad at the representatives in Washington who have proved not to think clearly and have damaged us. They're just angry, and they think, well, maybe somebody just comes up here and just, you know, kicks tail and just gets everybody out of here. Yay, God will really use it. God can use it. But remember this, God uses poor judgment and bad government because we have chosen that over what is right, and we are reaping the consequences of refusing to follow the principles that God says are as solid as the rock upon which we build our lives and our future. It's unshakable. We leave those, you know, we leave those foundation stones. It's amazing to me, Michael, that it seems like all of creation understands nature's God and nature's law, except the people created in his own image that he gave the ability to refuse and to reject the love and the wisdom he offers. And they are rejecting nature's God and nature's law. We are defying laws, and the defying of those laws is breaking us. So we've actually are putting people in place who are not the best leader. I think this president was put in place in many ways because America felt guilt for the way they had had racial tension and racial practices of racial attitudes and expressions, and they were thrilled to have a minority. They just got the one that did not seem to have the ability to lead wisely. And it's too bad because you could actually see the handwriting on the wall by the people he associated with and the things that he claimed to believe. And then he tried to talk around them when he was campaigning. But nevertheless, we made a bad decision there. We don't need to make another bad decision concerning the leadership, not only in the White House, but in both houses of Congress and in our local elections. We need people who understand principles, the principles that have been proven to be unshakable, meaningful, and effective. We have simply got to do that.
Yeah, and when Senator Ted Cruz was asked about fearing God, was that important for a candidate to be God-fearing? And he said, yes, of course, and a president should start every day with prayer. Of course, atheists and others were up in arms about that. And we don't have a religious test for a president, but I could not imagine being led nationally by someone that was not God-fearing. And the greatest issue today in America, in my judgment, is the lack of the consciousness of God. So we're not talking about establishing a theocracy. We're talking about someone who, because of the fear of God, has the principles to lead the nation wisely. And you can't separate the one from the other, can you?
No, you really can't. And the only theocracy we have to worry about being enacted today is the secular progressive theocracy. That's the one that's being forced on the American people. Those of us who know the freedom that Christ offers and the truth of his word, we're the last people who want a religion leading us. We want principles to lead us that are in line with biblical truth.
Yes, so friends, let's not get caught up in the political spirit, but let us get educated and let us act wisely for the moral and spiritual and social benefit of America. James, it's a joy as always speaking with you, and thanks for allowing me to be part of the Stream team.
Well, I hope everybody listening will go to the Stream, consider even making it your homepage, but go over there and follow it. Share some of the articles. In mine, I share 10 principles that are called the 10 cannots.
Yeah.
By Reverend Boddicker, and they are just fabulous. Those 10 things would be wonderful just to share with everybody. The candidates will read them.
Yeah, and by the way, I had not seen those before. I was embarrassed, but I had not seen those before I read them on your post. So thanks for sharing those, and look forward to chatting, God willing, next week.
All right, look forward to talking to you. Thank you, and God bless you. Thank you for your contribution.
My joy. All right, friends, that's the Stream, stream.org. I encourage you to visit there. And I want to go back to something I said yesterday, but I've said this for years and years and years. The great issue in America goes back to the state of the church. That's our great issue. America's messed up because the church is messed up. The church is messed up because leaders are messed up. I know that's a simplification, but ultimately, the key is awakening in the church. America's future and well-being depends on awakening within the church. And with that, evangelism, winning Americans to Jesus in a living and vibrant way. Not church tradition, not the Christian religion, but spiritual awakening that will have a radical impact, not just on our worship and our prayer, but on how we live our lives, how we conduct ourselves in the business world, how we conduct ourselves socially, politically, how we conduct ourselves with issues of justice in life. The resources we have this week, again, no hype. I'm not that kind of person. But when my staff member that goes over these things with me sat down and said, okay, here's what we're proposing, our team is proposing to offer this week, I said, can we afford to do this? When he told me the prices, because I know what books and things cost us, resources cost us, but assured me we can. So here's what we're offering you this week. My book, co-authored with Pastor John Kilpatrick, The Fire That Never Sleeps, about keys to personal awakening, edited by Larry Sparks, who put in tons of great information. We've gotten tremendous responses from readers to that book so far, great endorsements to it. And then my book, The Revival Answer Book, the common questions that come up about discernment in the midst of revival and how to recognize what really is God and what is not God. Those two books, which are full-length books, along with my CD, The Message, Holy Desperation, to listen to stir your heart, to go after God like never before. We've heard of many whose lives have been sparked for revival by listening to that message. All three, $20, including postage. Postage paid. So to order, call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, or go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, draw a circle. Get in the circle. Say, God, revive everything in this circle.